Welcome to this Monday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are glad that you are with us. We've got an hour worth of good stuff coming your way. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and a little bit later, get out your sky map, your sky atlas, your celestial map, whatever you want to call it. Wes Anderson, curator, historian, and director of North Dakota's only planetarium, tells us about the free show coming up Saturday at Valley City State University. Today on Main Street, we welcome Franny Tunseth, North Dakota's 2026 Teacher of the Year. She teaches math and reading intervention for grades 4-8 in the Mayville, Portland, Clifford, Galesburg schools, and has also served as a teacher and elementary principal in both North Dakota and Minnesota. Franny believes that all kids can experience success every single day when given the right support, a philosophy that guides her work with struggling students. She began her career in 2014 as a kindergarten teacher. We'll talk more about that here in just a bit. Franny, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here today and to talk about education.
Oh my goodness. And congratulations on your selection as North Dakota's Teacher of the Year. That's exciting.
It is really exciting. I think it's also very humbling. And I think one of my favorite things about it, Craig, is just being able to like talk with all the people that have poured into me as a teacher and as an individual and really share that with them as well. Because I think whenever we win an award like this, it's not necessarily a reflection of just us. It's a reflection of all of the other people we get to work with too, or have worked with us in the past. And so I think that's been so rewarding on this journey the last few weeks as well.
And you'll get to stand for National Teacher of the Year here in just a little bit. That'll be exciting too. But Franny, take me in the rewind machine for a minute. What inspired you to become a teacher?
Oh gosh. Well, I love that question, Craig. You know, I think that I was very fortunate to have a kindergarten teacher named Mrs. Susie Olson in Thief River Falls, Minnesota, who made kindergarten feel safe and really made learning feel joyful. And my mom tells stories of me coming home after school and lining up all of my teddy bears and my little brother and making them learn all the same things that I learned that day and really emulating and trying to model everything that Susie did. And as I reflect back, there's so many educators that have really shown me what it is to be an incredible teacher and an incredible person. And I really simply wanted to do what they did. I wanted to help little kids feel safe and seen. I wanted to help them make learning fun and joyful. And I just feel fortunate I get to do that now. You know, Craig, I was raised in a home where education was something we talked a lot about. My dad served on the local school board for many, many years. And so policy and education was often a topic at our dinner table. And so I just really grew to have a deep respect for the profession. My mom also works at an elementary school. She is a volunteer coordinator, and she always says she makes the fun happen. She gets to like raise money and have events and welcome in volunteers to help in classrooms. And so it was just something that was so instilled in my brother and I, that education is important, that it is something that is to be valued, and that teachers are respected. And so it's really no surprise to me. My brother and I are both educators. And I love when we all get to, all four of us get together and have conversations about current education and, you know, the incredibly great things that are happening and the incredibly hard. And I think that those conversations help and continue to drive my love of this passion.
So as you were matriculating through elementary school, junior high or middle school, and then high school, you had to make a decision to major in education.
I did.
Was that made real long ago, or was that kind of a, okay, I'm a senior now and that's what I'm going to do?
You know, Craig, so when I literally, from the time I was 5 years old, I wanted to be a teacher. And so whenever I was in middle school or high school, whenever we had like career days, I always talked about wanting to be a teacher. When we had opportunities for field experiences, we had like a capstone class where we could go in and choose what we wanted to do. I went back and I worked with Mrs. Olson in that way and was able to like almost be a teacher assistant. And it was so great. And I loved it. And then when I was going to start applying for colleges, that's back when we were in an era where you would try apply for a job and you'd have 50 to 100 applicants for a single teaching job, which is not the case anymore. And so I was doing some real soul searching, and somebody just came to me and said, like, I'm really worried about just the careers in education and getting a job. And I think you have the same traits that nurses have. So I actually had a little bit of a pivot there for a little bit. I went to school to be a nurse. I got my LPN degree at Northland Community and Technical College. And after I graduated and was starting to apply for RN schools, I sat my parents down and I said, I hate body fluids. I can't stand the sight of blood. I puke when other people puke. Like, I can't do this forever. And so it was just a very natural shift that I went back into education. And I remember like my first day of intro to education and calling my parents and being like, I feel like I'm home. Like, this is what I'm passionate about. This is what I've always wanted to do. And I never felt that when I was going to school to be a nurse. So I was very fortunate that I made that pathway back into education. Absolutely loved my education at the University of North Dakota. And then after I graduated with my bachelor's in elementary education, I had applied for this really unique program called the Resident Teacher Program through UND, where I was able to, get my master's in an accelerated one-year program and go to school on nights and weekends while being a first-year teacher as well. And so all of these little things have just kind of piled up that have just been such little, like, you know, incredible moments in my life where they've just kind of reaffirmed that this is where I'm supposed to be and this is where I feel like I am home. And now I can't imagine doing anything else.
You had to learn that you were nominated for Teacher of the Year.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
So I got an email from Jen Odell, who is the manager, and I'd gotten an email that I had been nominated for the, you know, County Teacher of the Year. And even that, it was just such an immense honor, because I think of all of the teachers that I get to work with and I'm fortunate to learn from and partner with every single day. And so it was just really like, it was just a very humbling experience that, wow, like somebody in our community or a student that I've made an impact in their life and that they think that this is something that I could win or, you know, that I could be nominated for. And so it was just a very humbling experience. You know, it puts a smile on your face. You know, but there are teachers that I work with or that my kids have that I nominated for that award as well. You know, they're just phenomenal educators. And I feel very fortunate to work in the Mayport CG School District, where there are so many incredibly, incredibly amazing educators that are really partnering and doing work for kids.
Take me behind the curtains a little bit of what the experience of teaching is today versus what you thought it was going to be when you were in middle school and in high school and even maybe in college.
That's such an interesting question, Craig. You know, I remember like even my husband and I actually met at my first job when I was a resident teacher at Lake Agassiz. And one of my favorite stories to tell is that I used to write like these elaborate 5-page parent newsletters that would highlight all the great things that were happening. And one day he was walking by my room and I was crying. And I said, oh my gosh, you have to tell me this gets easier. And he's like, stop doing more work, like writing 5-page newsletters and it well. And I think that in my head, I had this idea of what education was, right? It was like, you know, obviously making kids safe and helping them learn, but also like, you know, these incredible lesson plans and making your room look perfect and all of these things. And I think that the more that I get into education, there's a few things that I learn. I think number one is the importance of relationships. I think that it is so important that our kids are not going to learn unless they feel safe and that they know that you care about them. And so I always start my year with really forming strong relationships with kids that are based off of mutual respect. And I want to get to know them as people, right? I think at the core, like, yeah, we have these students come into our classroom and we're so lucky to be in their lives. But that comes with a great responsibility too. And so I want to know who these people are that are in my classrooms. That's number one. I think number two, the thing that I've also learned is like, you know, sometimes that ideal of like, it needs to be perfect is it's funny to me because it doesn't. Like, kids simply want somebody that's going to be present with them and we're going to make mistakes together. And I think that some of their favorite things are when I maybe don't do a lesson that's actually perfect and we can learn and work through that messy middle, together. And just really do learning with and from each other. You know, I think that I had this idea when I first started out that I would be like this transfer of knowledge and I'm going to give you all the knowledge. And that's not what education is. The education is, let's figure this out together. Let's partner together and let's figure out how we can do that in a way that is meaningful and engaging for students. And I think that I learn just as much from them as they learn from me. And that's something that I absolutely love and treasure.
Brandi, you talk about being present for everyone. And I think that has got to be an incredible challenge when you have 16, 20, 24, 26 little ones who are hoping that you are present for them.
Yeah.
But all of a sudden there's a couple over there you're being present with at the time. And then you've got the rest of it. How do you manage that?
I think it's like, I always say you have to steal the moments in a day, right? We're all given the same amount of time with our kids, but how can we figure out and maximize the time we have with them? And I've done that numerous ways throughout the past. You know, I used to do, when I was an elementary school teacher, we used to have lunch in the classrooms where I would pick different kids to come in and learn more about them and just be able to engage with each other over conversation and eating. But I think it's it's really about, number one, figuring out how our kids feel, love, and support the most. I know that I often do at the start of the class or the start of the school with my class, I do like the 5 love languages because all kids are going to feel love in a different way. And so if we're only giving kids words of affirmation, but they actually want that quality time, they're not going to feel that love and appreciation and that support. So I think it's really understanding what makes our kids tick and then giving it to them in a way where they feel that support and that love. And so, like I said, Craig, I think it's trying to steal that time throughout a day and honestly just doing the best you can.
I've heard from other teachers that the teacher's lounge is really different today than it was when I was in school. And you talk about wanting to give your time at lunch mm-hmm. with some students that you have. Mm-hmm. So is it an older guard, younger guard thing in the teacher's lounge these days? Franny, can you take us behind the scenes there?
Craig, I am so fortunate. Our teacher's lounge, when we eat, it's about all middle school teachers have lunch at the same time. And so it really is this powerful place where we are able to sense make together and bring ideas and questions or concerns or things that we're struggling with and just really be able to engage in it in a really authentic, safe way. I feel so fortunate. I'd like to know more about the teacher lounge back, Craig, when you were going to school and what it was like back then.
As a student, the fear of God was in us if we went near the place. I can tell you that.
Oh, golly.
And now I watch Abbott Elementary, right? I don't mm-hmm. know if you're a fan of that show or
I've
not, but they.
It. Yeah. And it's very comical. There are some things that happen on there that you just kind of have to laugh at because sometimes those crazy things that happen, you're like, that doesn't happen. And they do, you know, it's just comical to me.
You wrote, and we mentioned this in the open, that all kids can experience success mm-hmm. every single day, Franny.
Yeah.
And what an awesome goal, but of course, there are ups and downs mm-hmm. with kids, with families, with mm-hmm. teachers. How do you manage that?
I think it's taking it very manageably by just taking bite-sized pieces. And like we talk very openly in my classroom that we will experience success every single day, but that success might look differently. And I think that's just a part of human life, right? Like not every day is going to be a good day, but there's going to be good things that happen every day. And so that is something that I really want to instill in my students where, you know, your success on one day might be that you were simply able to sit and to read for 5 minutes without being interrupted. And the next day it might be because you did a fantastic presentation to your class. But you're right. There are good things and there are bad things. And I think that, you know, in our class, we do a really good job of celebrating the success every single day, but then also finding time to live in the challenges and acknowledge those head on and talk about how learning can be messy and learning can be hard. But when we're engaged in that hard stuff, it's kind of where the magic happens. Like something is hard because it means that you're working at it. And if something's too easy, you know, that's not necessarily a good thing too. And so I think it's just being very vulnerable with kids and having those conversations.
We are enjoying our conversation with North Dakota's 2026 Teacher of the Year, Franny Tunseth. She teaches math and reading intervention, grades 4 through 8 in Mayport CG. Did I get that right?
You got it right.
Abbreviation of the school district there. Franny, you've taught in Minnesota. You've taught mm-hmm. in North Dakota. You're now a veteran teacher. Technology, boy, it's changes. It's there for us and it changes. AI. There it is now. What the heck is this? How are things changing that you want to make sure that our listeners understand that, boy, education is changing, but that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I think that there are so many incredibly great and incredibly hard things that happen in schools every single day across our state, right? And I think that I feel so fortunate that I work in North Dakota where education really is valued and I feel like it's celebrated. I think that even this award and the amazing work that the Department of Education does to highlight it showcases how much they are invested in education and I really appreciate their leadership. You know, you talked about a couple, Craig. I think technology is evolving faster than we can even manage. And so I think that with that comes difficulties because we want to make sure that we are providing opportunities for our students to go and be successful in our world. But that comes with a big responsibility too. If we don't necessarily understand these tools, how can we teach it? And so I think that as teachers, we're constantly trying to figure out like what are the best ways that we can interact with our students and give them opportunities to interact with these different tools in a safe setting. And then how can we use them to teach it or how can we teach them to use it in a very respectful and powerful way. You know, you think of AI, it's very easy to go on and have it write a paper or do your homework for you, but that doesn't mean that you're going to get better or smarter or have the knowledge. So how can we utilize some of those tools in ways that are both ethical and responsible. And I think that's a conversation that I have almost every single day with my sixth, seventh, and eighth graders related to just those different tools. You know, I think that funding is another thing that is constantly on the hearts of educators and just trying to figure out, like, how can we do more with less? You know, I work in a rural school where, you know, we're not just teachers. Like, we wear so many hats during the day, and it's something that I absolutely relish and love. But just trying to think about, you know, sometimes our resources are not the same as somebody who lives in a Grand Forks or a Bismarck, because we don't have the capacity. You know, we don't have mental health coordinators. We don't have, you know, a human service director that works right in our schools. So I think that within those difficulties, though, come a lot of really great things where we're able to partner with our community and with our local agencies to have support. But I think that that's just a really real constraint that living in rural schools and working in a rural school, we do sometimes have funding or resource issues.
Brandy, do you feel now that you have this responsibility to advocate to policymakers, to advocate to community, to carry the torch, if you will, for public education in North Dakota?
I do. And you know, that's, I, Craig, when we, when I was given this award in Bismarck, I was talking with the ND United team. And I was just talking about too, how, you know, I'm currently going for my PhD degree in elementary or in teaching and leading. And in one of these classes, we were talking all about policy and professional development. And I said, it's really interesting as I'm reading the history of policy and PD and all of these different things. Like, sometimes we have the people that are the furthest away from education making policy decisions about education. And I said, I think that people do the best they can and they all have really great hearts. But I think it's on us to try and advocate and to show them maybe the different things that we need. And I had talked about, like, I would love for policymakers, come and spend a day in my shoes. Come and work with me for a day and see some of these real constraints in real time. Because I think that it's important. And so, yeah, that's something that I take very much to heart, is how can I advocate and how can I showcase the great things that are happening, but also try to amplify teacher voices to some of the things that we need or some of the things that are kind of hard right now.
Franny, why is public school still so important for our kids?
Gosh, I just think of the power of a community, Craig. You know, I feel very fortunate that I work in a small school, and I always say that small schools and rural schools, it is the heart of the community. And if you take that away, it makes me feel very scared and very sad, because there's so many incredible, great things that happen. I think that I was raised in a public school setting and I have a heart for it. I think that there's so many incredible things that happen. The power of partnerships, the power of community, the power of, you know, giving students equal access and equal opportunities to learn and succeed. I just think that there's a lot of really important core values that happen in a public school. And like you said, just excited to be able to advocate and to showcase those things off over the next year.
You talk a lot about family involvement.
Yeah.
We've talked about it in the interview. Give us an example of how you engage families from maybe two perspectives. Mm-hmm. We all know of the parents who are just really involved. They're there for parent-teacher conferences. Mm-hmm. They are with their kid every step of the way. And then there are other parents, maybe from a child from a single parent family whose parents maybe are working a lot to support the family, that don't have maybe the time to be as involved. How do you work that with both of those types of students?
Absolutely. Well, I think it comes down to, first of all, is giving all parents grace. Parenting is hard, Craig. I have four of my own kids and I don't get it right all the time. And I probably am not as involved as I want to be even in education, because there's just simply not enough time to do all of the things as a parent. So I think first it comes down to giving parents grace and trying to work around their schedule. I worked for an incredible man by the name of Patrick Moraltz, and he was my elementary principal actually when I was in fifth grade. He was my intro to education teacher when I went to UND. And then he actually was the principal when I went and taught in Thief River. And he had a very firm belief that we need to make contact with all parents within the first month of school. And you are trying to set up that positive relationship and let these parents know that you see their child and that you appreciate them. And that's something that I've really taken with me. I think that at the heart of it, as a mom, I want to make sure that my kids are liked and that they are respected as tiny people before I even worry about learning. And so I tried to do a really great job of connecting with parents and letting them know and highlighting the great things that their kids are doing every single day. I think if we're only contacting parents to get involved once there are issues or once there's learning difficulties, I think that we're missing the boat. And I think it's unfair to parents. So that's the first thing, is to have a positive relationship with parents before any issues arise. I think when you have the parents that want to be really involved, that's great. I think it's that open, honest communication And then giving them resources if they want to work at home. With the parents that's not as involved, I think that it's just trying to be really creative about how you're reaching them. You know, they might not be a parent that's coming in, but I'm sure they're a parent that would answer their cell phone or even answer a text. And so just trying to be very creative about how you can get them involved or what involvement even looks like for them on that level. But I think it comes down to very open communication and very frequent communication. Our parent-teacher conferences actually aren't until they're next week, but I've been doing parent-teacher conferences the last 2 weeks to get parents in early and hear the great things that are happening and then just kind of talk a little bit about how can we partner together. And I think it's really exciting that I had 100% of my parents come in. That meant that I was maybe here a little bit earlier than my contracted time and stayed a little bit later than my contracted time. But I think when we partner with parents, amazing things can happen. And, you know, at the heart of it, parents want their kids to do well too and to be successful. And so it's just having those conversations of what can we do to help them be successful.
Franny, we've all read that North Dakota and many other states too face challenges in recruiting and retaining teachers, especially in rural areas where you are. Based on your experience, are there changes or supports that you think that really need to be in place to keep great teachers? You mentioned earlier, hundreds of people used to apply. That doesn't happen anymore. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on making the profession in the state more attractive?
I think that's a really important conversation that I can't wait to have this year, Craig, is what I think. I have a friend by the name of Darian who is doing a fantastic dissertation right now that is actually talking about why are teachers staying? And I look very much forward to reading this final paper of hers because I think there's going to be a lot of important things that come out of it. You're right. There's a teacher shortage issue. And I think the state's doing a lot of really unique things to try and get the pipeline going, right? We have the para to teacher professionalization. There's a different programs where you can go through it in a really fast way, right? But I think part of that conversation has to be, yes, not only how do we get teachers into the profession, but how do we get teachers to stay? And I think the thing that we have to do with that is have conversations and be vulnerable enough to hear those conversations and what their answers are. I've engaged in some of those conversations just at my district in the area that we're in right now. And there are people that are actively thinking about leaving education because of, you know, they say it's unsustainable to be in a career where you give so much of yourself, right? And I just really try to mentor and to partner with those people and talk about, like, you know, some of the reasons why to stay. I think it's really important that we are here to help our kids. And it makes me as a mom very nervous to think about all of these great teachers that are leaving the classrooms. And I'm sure, you know, Craig, we had talked earlier about your granddaughter. I'm sure as a grandpa, that makes you feel very nervous and uncomfortable too. And so I think the first thing we need to do is have conversations with people that are leaving education and ask why. And my follow-up question that I always want to ask them too is, what could the field of education done to keep you to stay? And I think that in that power of communication and in the power of those conversations, we could find some really unique ways that we could try and partner with legislation, with school districts to try and get educators to stay. But I think that that is something that I really want to work on over this next year, is to try and figure out, like, what are some of the innovative ways that we can try and keep people to stay in education while that pipeline problem is happening and getting people into our field as well.
Do teachers have a responsibility to recruit the next generation of teachers? Do you take that on?
I constantly try to. I talk to high school kids all the time where I'm like, you know, it's a great profession, teaching, and welcoming them into our classrooms too. But I think it's a community thing. Right? I think that especially in the hearts of small rural communities, I think that all community members can try and advocate for that and talking to young people to talk about the reasons why education is a great choice and the respect that teachers do have and how we can help support teachers to feel those things.
Funniest story you can share without giving any private information away as we wrap things up, Franny, about an experience you've had in the classroom.
Oh my goodness, Craig, there are so many of them. You know, we had talked about how I taught kindergarten at the very beginning, and kindergarten is a world of itself. And I think that there were stories that I was coming home all of the time. You know, I think that I was actually just telling, I'll tell you a story that one of my middle schoolers, we were talking the other day and somebody had gotten sick in the class and they were like, well, at least it wasn't on you. And I said, golly, that actually has happened. And they were mortified. And I said, this poor little kindergartner was just so sick to his stomach. And I did the things all teachers do, like, go get a drink of water, you're okay. And then, nope, we got sick right in my hand. And then I got very very sick in my other hand. And like, you know, those are the things that really happen. And I called my
because you wanted to be a nurse at one time and decided that wasn't for you.
I called my parents afterwards and I said, you are never going to believe what happened today. And they just laughed and they said, it is so good you did not go to school to be a nurse. And I'm like, I know. I'm so glad that I am where I'm at. And let's hope that doesn't happen again in a very long time.
Franny Tunseth, best wishes to you. And thank you so much for sharing your inspiring journey with our listeners. Certainly congratulations on becoming the North Dakota 2026 Teacher of the Year. We wish you the best in the future, Franny.
Well, I really appreciate that. And thank you for having me on today to share a little bit more about me and some of the things happening in education right now. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Still ahead on Main Street, if you've never seen a planetarium, how about a trip this Saturday for a free event at the only planetarium in North Dakota? That's after this news.
The Fargo Moorhead Choral Artists and conductor Michael Culleton presents Sing Unto the Sky. The 80-voice ensemble performs choral works inspired by the natural world. October 18th and 19th at Trinity Lutheran Church in Moorhead. Details at fmchoralartists.org.
And Main Street continues on this Monday. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and we're joined again by our good friend Wes Anderson. He's the curator of the Barnes County Museum and, of course, has his affiliation with the Barnes County Historical Society. Wes, welcome back to Main Street.
Yes, good morning, Craig.
It's fun to check in with you every now and again. We have a special event coming up. It's Star Search, and it's coming upon us soon. Can you give us some more information about that?
Well, and this is my other hat. I also am the director of the VCSU Planetarium. And so that is the only planetarium in North Dakota. We've been there since 1973, and I've been there since 1993. So, yeah, 30 years in the dark, it explains a lot. My predecessor is Dr. Eileen Starr, a wonderful name for a planetarium director. And she taught me everything I know. I was in her class. She created the first class, as far as we know, anywhere in the world where the students learn the operations of the planetarium hands-on through the creation of an original planetarium show. And so as the class she designed, the students decide upon a topic in the fall. They research that topic, and they write an original script that is then recorded, and the audio is used by the spring semester to produce into a show for public display. So it's something. When she retired in 2002, I got hired because I can push buttons and change light bulbs, but I've been continuing it ever since. And yes, Star Search. These are two shows. There's Star Search and Constellation Costume Crew. They're both new shows. They've not really been witnessed by the public yet, and it's a little embarrassing, but we've been really out of step with things for quite a while. COVID really threw a monkey wrench into the works, and so Star Search is actually an old show. It was written in 2019 by a pair of students, and it was indeed took a little while to record it, but we got it recorded and edited, and the next semester, spring of 2020, that's when everything shut down, and my students in that class then had to take the audio and try and create their own videos to go with it. And well, yeah, some of them used the wrong format and some of them, but it was all chaos at that time. So anyway, it's taken me a little while to get it edited into something that's actually usable for us, but finally we're ready to present it to the public. And so it is a teacher by the name of Mr. Starr who is taking a pair of students through the seasons of the planetarium to seek out the brightest star in the night sky. And we start out in the spring sky with it, with usually Regulus, I believe it is, and then we have to move on into the summer sky, and they find Vega, and we go into the fall night sky, and they locate Markab as well as Al Ghul. And then they go into the winter sky, and I won't do any spoilers. But Constellation Costume Crew is a group of kids dressed as constellations of the fall night sky, and so they knock on a lady's door, and, hey, what are you kids dressed as? Because she doesn't recognize the constellations. And they get to tell them a little bit of the mythology as well as some science behind the stars. And yeah, we're looking forward to that. It's pretty much the sky that you would look up to tonight and see. The Summer Triangle is up there, and Ovoucus, the snake wrestler, and Hercules. Let's see, you have Scorpio and Sagittarius, as well as Boötes and Corona Borealis. And yeah, it's a fun little show for kids.
So Wes, this begins at 1 o'clock on Saturday, October 18th, in room 309 of the Rhodes Science Center on the Valley City State University campus. And it is free, as you say. So this is a great family event, Wes?
Yes. Yeah, I would say so. Yeah, that we encourage young people to come for us. A lot of these, there's some that are better for little kids, but we go to a 4th to 8th grade audience usually, and so that's kind of what we aim for.
Describe for me, Wes, what people see when they come into the planetarium. What's it look like?
Stars.
Yeah. What's the space?
Well, let's see. It's a dome. It's a 24-foot dome. We seat 50. It's a very good representation of the night sky. It's with a Spitz 512 machine. And so,
what's that?
It's a planetarium projecting device. It's an optomechanical system that uses a specially created can, if you would. It's a ball. And inside of it, a really bright light that shoots out stars onto the dome. And it's a very accurate representation of the night sky. I mean, outside is much larger and far more realistic, but this is a pretty good representation of it. And with this, we are able to travel through the seasons. We can change our latitudes and see how the sky looks at different parts of the world. We can't really go to the southern hemisphere very well because of its design. It's got a counterweight on the bottom that has the planets. And so it actually accurately represents where the planets are in tonight's night sky. And we can go forward in time or ahead in time, but it's all very analog, so it sometimes is a little slower than, you know, I can't take you back to the dawn of time with it. So I wouldn't recommend that. But yeah, I can take you ahead to what stars are next year, or I can show you the waltz of the planets as they move through the sky. Especially fun to watch Venus and Mercury as they appear to, well, move through the sky and do their epicycles in the sky. That's what Ptolemy saw.
Tell me how you coordinate, I guess, events like this, Wes. What's your goal to have them maybe quarterly? Do you do something weekly at the planetarium? How do you manage the planetarium?
Well, we have a lot of school groups that go through in the spring. We try and do at least one public show a month. And a lot of what we do is in concert with the VCSU Medicine Wheel as well on the Hill. It's for bus groups or anybody that likes to come for, you know, a large group or, you know, we can negotiate things. But yes, it's we do offer it for free. And that's part of the class too, is the students learn the shows and present them, and then they are paid $25 a show. So it's a part of their education as well to learn the constellations and how the machine works and public presentation of them to further their education.
We're enjoying our conversation with our friend Wes Anderson. He talks to us periodically here on Main Street. He's the curator of the Barnes County Museum, works with the Barnes County Historical Society, wears many hats, and also is a big force in the planetarium, the only planetarium in the state of North Dakota at Valley City State University. Wes, I want to turn our conversation to have you tell us what's new at the Barnes County Historical Society and at the museum.
Constantly changing around exhibits. We have a very small space with which to work and so many stories to tell that, you know, we have to move things around and bring new objects out and more stories to tell, the better. It keeps people coming back. So we are actually waiting for our exhibits to come in for our National World War II Heritage Community designation. We were awarded this back in August of last year, and we put out a huge effort here to create outdoor kiosk exhibits around our community, as well as some for inside the museum related to World War II and the home front. And it's a very compelling story of what our little community here offered to World War II, and a lot of unique connections and stuff you wouldn't expect. So it's we're very proud of what we have to offer here, and our designation.
With being named an American World War II Heritage City by the National Park Service West, I've wondered, we've talked about that on Main Street before, have things come to a grinding halt because of the government shutdown as you want to plan and move forward and have different events?
Well, I suppose a step at a time and a wait-and-see approach on a lot of that, but our exhibits and our local effort here has been going on at light speed, so we have... Sandy Hansen has been our coordinator on making the exhibits of things. Mary Lee Nielsen has honchoed the project, and so it has come together really incredibly quickly here. But it helped that we had so much information on hand and ready to go, and so that has served us very well and brought us to a point here where we're just about ready to install stuff outside, hopefully before snow. But we were looking at trying to do something here in October for it, but I think it's probably going to be more November by the time we do that. So that'll be another lecture coming up on the process to get us to this point, as well as the stories that we're telling. We have amazing stuff into here. We have, well, let's see, the story of at campus, for example, at VCSU. Here's one that I bet nobody knows. There is a bust of Abraham Lincoln that was created by Paul Feldy back in 1914. By the state of North Dakota. They commissioned him to make this bust, and it was given to Norway by the state of North Dakota in celebration of their centennial. And during World War II, it's in Frogner Park in Oslo, and during World War II, it was a rallying point for Norwegians to silently protest against Nazi occupation. And so, yeah, it's the artist's artist casting, what is it? The artist proof, there we go, is still on campus here at VCSU in the library, Allen Memorial Library, and the real one's in Frogner Park. But it's a unique link to World War II, and during the whole time, Valley City was rallying to send supplies to Norway to support them in occupied Norway. And so they had clothing drives, they had food drives, they had all kinds of stuff that was supposed to head over to Norway and help them. And part of this, too, we had the 99th Infantry. If you haven't heard of them, it is a group of men from North Dakota, Minnesota, Wisconsin that were fluent Norwegian speakers. They might not have been born in Norway, but they spoke Norwegian as good as Norwegians. And they were part of this 99th Infantry that was supposedly going to be part of the invasion of Norway through Northern Europe to help in the Nazi occupation and World War II. And they trained down in Colorado, but a lot of guys from the area here served in the 99th Infantry and with distinction. So it's a neat story. All of these things, they pull together so many unique stories that we are all very proud of to offer to the public.
Wes, I had forgotten that the Barnes County Historical Society Museum is the oldest county museum in North Dakota. When was it formed?
We started out in 1930 on the third floor of our Barnes County Courthouse. The original courthouse was built in 1881, and it burned in a tragic fire on the 50th anniversary of Barnes County in 1924. And the new replacement was built in 1925-26. It was inaugurated. And 1930 was at the Women's Relief Corps, the Daughters of the American Revolution, a couple other ones got together. The Daughters of the Pioneers, or Pioneer Club, came together and decided that they needed a museum for the county to reflect upon the citizens of our county and our history and how we've been here. And, on the third floor it started, and it was there for 60 years. It was moved out of there in 1990 to a smaller building on the edge of town. It was moved here to our former Fair Store building in 1997 is where I moved it to, and I was the first curator hired. And, I've been here ever since. I'm part of the furniture, I'm afraid.
Would you say the mission of the museum is different today than it was in 1930, or are the guiding principles the same?
Certainly it has to deal with space. A lot of stuff has to deal with gathering information and storytelling and getting the information out to people to learn and appreciate from the past. So no, in those respects, it has not. We've become a lot more active. We have our lecture series once a month. We have our ongoing oral history project. We are supporting a lot of preservation efforts in the area. We're working with other local museums to try and get things promoted and get visitors and more appreciation to our local history. I don't know. It has to do with space and time and I guess the ability to tell as many stories as we possibly can in a limited space and limited amount of time in certain respects. But
can I still
continuing to happen?
Can I still see Gundy if I come to the museum, Wes?
Gundy is still here. Yes, that is on loan from the North Dakota Geological Survey. She's about 14 feet long. It's a juvenile female Triceratops that was found in northwestern South Dakota by Mike Trebold from Valley City. And this is his first project. He went out and found the real fossils and brought them back to Valley City and started making replicas that were then for sale around the world. And that's how his business as Trebold Paleontology kicked off. And he's since become a world-renowned paleontologist and is very famous for his castings that are indeed in museums everywhere. And for a while, we had a really unique relationship that when he finished making a dinosaur up there at his shop, that it would premiere here at the museum. And we would be his showroom, and people would fly in on a jet and come in and say, yeah, we'll take one of those, and off it would go to Milan or off to Paris or off to Rome, or, you know, big museums around the world would come here and see what Mike had created. But he's moved on to Colorado, and Gundy here came to us, I said, through the Geological Survey. He gave that to them, and it was in pieces. It wasn't assembled. So they loaned it to a museum in Tennessee a number of years ago in exchange for them to put it together, to mount it. And then they found a mastodon that needed the parking space, so they sent Gundy back home. And North Dakota, we didn't really have a place big enough in their facilities to display it. And they knew that we could do the care and feeding of one of these because we'd had Bob. Bob the Triceratops was from Alan Komrosky in Hell Creek Relics. And that was the world's largest Triceratops, most complete. It was 90% complete. But unfortunately, it was sold and is now in South Korea. But Gundy is here, and we've had her now since about 10 years, I'm going to say. We're proud to have this here as part of the story of Mike Trebold and Trebold Paleontology. And last year, we had Oliver was a Triceratops that Alan Komrosky and Hell Creek Relics had found in southwestern North Dakota. I could be wrong on that. But anyway, he had it here still in the field jackets. And we had a unique displaying of that, of red string going between the fossil, real fossil of Oliver to the casting that is Gundy, and showed the correlation between what it looks like in the field jackets as it came out of, you know, where it was discovered, and what it looks like in situ.
Well, tell us what's on your radar, Wes. I'm sure the World War II work is going to take a lot of your time. Is there anything else that we should be looking forward to over the next year or two?
Oh, I always have fun things up my sleeves. Last year was our county's 150th anniversary, and so we put together exhibits helping tell the stories of the communities in Barnes County. And this year was the 125th anniversary of the Ladies Line, which was all of these towns along a spur of the Northern Pacific coming out of Castleton that went down to Marion. And the towns along there, Marion, Catherine, Alice, Lucca, Persis, they're all named after women. Except for Litchfield, I guess. But anyway, but they're all created in 1900, and so this year they celebrated their 125th anniversaries, and we kind of highlighted them. So what's coming up in the future? I really don't know right now. I've been so busy.
Wes, give us the hours of the museum.
Well, officially they're 10 to 4, Monday through Saturday, and it's free will admission, and Sunday's by appointment. So, yeah, we're here. We have, like I said, monthly month of the lectures coming up. We're trying to get one here going in October. This World War II project, getting in the signs that we created, is we were guessing when we were establishing the calendar. So we guessed close, but it's going to be more November than October. So I have to find in a filling space for October now. It was going to be on the 16th, and then we were thinking about the 23rd, and maybe I'll just do. We did a 16 millimeter movie fest last year, so maybe I'll do that again this year.
Well, we'll keep in touch and we'll keep our listeners informed. My guest has been Wes Anderson. He's the curator of the Barnes County Museum. Also is a principal with the only planetarium in the state of North Dakota. That's in room 309 of the Rhodes Science Center on the Valley City State University campus. They have a special program this coming Saturday. Great for kids and their parents. 1 o'clock, it's called Star Search. And at 1:35 p.m., Constellation Costume. Both are new shows that are debuting this Saturday here at the planetarium. Wes, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for joining us on Main Street.
Thank you, Craig. Much appreciated.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Alzheimer's Association Minnesota North Dakota, offering the Empowered Caregiver Series, educational courses aimed to help caregivers feel more prepared to handle the challenges that come with caring for someone living with dementia. Learn more at alz.org/MNND.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for Hidden Brain. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Health Partners, offering a simplified approach to health plans, customer service, and community partnerships in North Dakota. Learn more at healthpartners.com/Dakota Plans.
This is Dakota Datebook for October 13th. October is American Archives Month, where archives around the country celebrate the records in their holdings and recognize the archivists who assess, collect, organize, preserve, and provide access to information of lasting value. The North Dakota State Archives is part of the State Historical Society of North Dakota. In March 1907, Jesse A. Tanner took temporary charge of the museum and library of the State Historical Society, which the Tribune reported had quarters in the new wing of the Capitol. The acting curator was a graduate from the Valley City Normal School and the University of North Dakota. And he delved into his work, which at the time was soliciting historical documents and artifacts, traveling to sites, and working with the museum and library housed in the Capitol building. He operated under a salary of $100 a month. Tanner, like many others, had already been involved with the Historical Society. He had researched ethnicity around the state, mainly by writing letters asking people for information. In 1905, Abbot Vincent Worley from St. Mary's Abbey in Richardton responded, estimating population numbers and dates of immigration, mainly for German, Russian, and Hungarian populations. He wrote, "I cannot find any great peculiarities or customs in these people. Many Americans are inclined to look upon them as a curiosity. I have the conviction that they, as a whole, are an excellent class of citizens. There are some peculiarities. They build mud houses. Poverty compelled them to do so. But theirs are a great deal more substantial and comfortable than the sod houses of other people. They may have large crowds at their weddings, where they may sing and dance and perhaps drink some beer. Other people do the same without being commented on. These people are under great disadvantages when they reach this country. They come very poor, for the rich are not in need of a new home. But it is really astonishing how most of them have worked themselves up within a few years. Before many years from now, the most skeptical will have to confess that they have proved themselves as a true acquisition and a blessing for our state." And where can you see that letter? Why, the North Dakota State Archives, of course. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by archivist Sarah Walker. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
The St. Olaf Orchestra, conducted by Chung Park, will visit North Dakota as part of its 2025 fall tour, with concerts in Fargo on October 18th, Minot on October 19th, and Bismarck on October 20th. The program includes Tchaikovsky's Symphony No. 5, Valerie Coleman's 7 o'clock shout, student soloists, and more. Ticket information is available at stolaf.edu/tickets.
And that wraps up this Monday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Tomorrow on Main Street, we'll welcome Alicia Bloffus, a Wahpeton native who's now providing psychiatric care in her hometown. We'll learn about her career journey, talk about the need for services, and the issues ahead. That's ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope you can join us again.